Today we come to the seventh lecture in the series, The Origin and Nature of Central Banking and the Federal Reserve System. We pointed out in our last lecture that the bank's cash is the lever with which the whole financial system is today manipulated. Where does the commercial bank obtain its cash from? One obvious constituent of the bank's cash is actual currency, that is, notes and coins. A bank must at any time have a certain amount of currency in its tills for paying out cash to such of its customers as bring checks in to be cashed. In most modern countries, but not in all, the currency consists in the main of notes issued by an institution known as the Bank of Issue, or Central Bank. A central bank is an institution charged with the responsibility of regulating the supply, availability, and cost of money in the interest of the general public. In order to regulate the quantity of money, the central bank is given a special group of powers that other institutions do not possess, or that they possess only in a limited degree. These special powers may be allocated to more than one organization, although only one institution is generally known as a central bank. The student must note the distinction between a central bank, which is an institution, and central banking, which refers to a special group of powers to control the stock of money. It is not illogical, therefore, to refer to the Federal Reserve System as the central bank in the United States, and at the same time to refer to the central banking functions of the U.S. Treasury or other federal agencies whose spheres of activity affect monetary and banking policy. It should be noted, however, that no one alludes to the Treasury or federal credit agencies as a central bank. Today, almost all countries have central banks, although it has only been in the present century the importance of central banking has gained wide recognition. The establishment of central banks in the modern sense dates back to the 19th century. The Bank of England was granted a monopoly of note issue in 1833, and it wasn't until Peel's Act of 1844 that its powers as a central bank were clearly formulated. In passing, if ever you have a chance to go to London, England, be sure to visit the Bank of England, which was founded by a good Calvinist king, King William of Orange. And on the entrance, the great brass doors, over the brass doors are inscribed the beautiful words of the psalm, "The earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof." Would to God that the Bank of England had remained true to that founding motto. The complex financial problems that wars and economic crises of the 20th century have produced accorded central banking a distinct role in both the theory and practice of finance. The economic, political, and social changes that occurred between the two world wars catapulted the principles and operations of central banking into the center of the economic stage. The great worldwide expansion of central banks, both in numbers and in powers, occurred during the 1920s. Since 1929, central banking has been characterized by increased state participation, culminating in the movement after World War II to nationalize privately owned central banks. Nationalization of the Bank of England and France are examples. Throughout the world, governments have taken measures to integrate central banks more closely into the machinery for carrying out public economic policy. What are the activities and functions of central banks? The functions of a central bank are vastly different from those of commercial banks. The business of the central bank is to control the money stock in such a way as to promote the interests of the general public. In order to perform its prime function of controlling the stock of money in the interest of general welfare, the central bank is generally endowed with the following powers. First, to hold and manage reserves of the commercial banks, to act as lender of last resort. Secondly, to issue currency. Third, to serve as fiscal agent of national governments. There should be a little three there referring to the reference. First, the management of bank reserves. The key to control over commercial banks lies in the control of their deposits with the Federal Reserve
all their reserves at the Fed and hence of their money and credit creating power. The central bank holds much of the reserves of these banks and so it acts as the guardian of the ultimate reserves of the country, which support its credit and banking system. Other banks hold deposits on the books of the central bank or notes that it issues. The cash of the member banks thus consists partly of notes issued by the central bank, partly of deposits with the central bank. In both cases, however, and this is the essential point, underline this, the member bank's cash consists of liabilities of the central bank. The sum total of notes that can be issued is fairly closely defined by law, and the amount of them held by the commercial banks does not vary greatly. The member bank's deposits with the central bank, however, are subject to considerable variations. When we are thinking of variations in the total of the member bank cash, it is to their deposits with the central bank we must direct our attention. Underline the next point. The central bank stands to the member banks in exactly the same relation as the member banks stand themselves to the public. The man in the street regards his bank deposit as cash, as money. It serves him as a useful way of making payments to his fellow customers of the bank. And if he wants actual currency for living expenses, he can get it by drawing on his account with the bank. Similarly, the member banks and their relation to the central bank. They regard their deposits with the central bank as cash, and they use them for making payments to their fellow member banks. And they can draw upon them for such supplies of legal tender money as they require. The analogy can be carried one vital step further. The member banks, subject to the limits we have already discussed in bank expansion and contraction, one of which was the maintenance of a due proportion of cash, can increase and diminish the size of their assets, and thus of their liabilities at will. This means they can increase or diminish the supply of money available to the public. Now, the central bank is a peculiar sort of bank. It has special functions to perform, and it is relieved of competition in its special field. But it is still a bank. And like any other bank, it can acquire assets by giving promises to pay. But if the central bank increases its assets and liabilities, it is also increasing the cash of the member banks, enabling them in their turn to expand their assets and liabilities and so increase the money supply of the community. Just as the member banks can create money, provided they have the requisite cash reserves, so the central bank can create the cash reserves of the member banks. And what it can create, it can also destroy. Comprehension of this mechanism is so vital to understanding the way in which the banking system works, it may perhaps be labored here. When a central bank makes a loan, it does so in the same way as any other bank, by crediting the account of the borrower on its books. If the borrower is one of the member banks, this will automatically increase its cash. If the borrower is not one of the member banks, for example, the government, he will presumably not have borrowed merely in order to increase his balance, but will proceed to pay it away. The checks which he draws and his balance at the central bank will be deposited by their recipients in the member banks, who will present them for payment to the central bank. Payment will be made by the federal bank by transfers from the account of the original borrower to the account of the member banks, which transfers increases the member bank's cash. Or suppose the central bank has increased its assets not by making a loan but by buying securities. The sellers of the securities will be paid either by having their accounts at the central bank credited or more probably by a check drawn of the central bank itself. This check will be deposited with one of the member banks who will present it for payment and have its cash increased accordingly. Thus, whoever receives in the first place the central bank's promises to pay, which it issues in exchange for the increase in its assets, they will all eventually come into the possession of the member banks and help to swell their reserves of cash. Moreover, a small creation by the central bank may result in a large creation by the member banks. For example, if the central bank increases its assets by $1 million by buying securities or granting a loan in that amount, the cash of the member banks will also be increased by $1 million. But if the member banks preserve their cash ratio of 10%, they'll proceed to expand their assets, other than cash, by another $9 million, thus increasing their total deposits by $10 million. The central bank thus has the very important power of being able to vary upwards and downwards the quantity of money available to the public. Is this power subject to any limitation? We saw in examining the powers of an ordinary bank can only increase its assets and liabilities in proportions to its holdings of cash. A central bank is subject to the same limitations, for its promises to pay must similarly be met in currency on demand. Now, one form of the central bank's promises to pay is its notes. Our currency, and the foregoing statement might seem to imply that a central bank is only under obligation to redeem its promises to pay with further promises to pay. This is, in fact, the position in many countries. Every Bank of England £1 note bears on the face of it the words, "I promise to pay," signed by the chief cashier of the Bank of England. But in sober truth, there is no mortal thing which the Bank of England is bound to pay that £1 note except another £1 note. The power of the central bank to increase the total available amount of money would therefore seem to be subject to no limitation, so long as the ultimate form of money in which all others are redeemable is merely one of its own promises to pay. At times in monetary history, notably in Germany in 1923, central banks have in fact created ever-increasing amounts of money with terrible results. But in most countries, their powers are held in check. In those countries which were on the gold standard, the law prescribed the liabilities of central banks had to be payable on demand, not only in currency, but also in gold. This clearly limited the extent to which liabilities could be increased, for not even a central bank can create gold. The gold plays the same role in the central bank as cash does in the member bank. Now, as we'll see, what I'm saying here then is that the God in his sovereign grace uses gold as a restraint on men's greed and lust for money which they haven't earned by the sweat of their brow. It's a sort of discipline, which is part, I think, of his common grace for the government of this world. Now, in many countries, whether they're on the gold standard or not, the law lays down that the liabilities of the central bank are not to exceed the prescribed multiple of its holdings of gold. But even in those countries which don't have these direct restrictions, an indirect check can be imposed by limiting the amount of the central bank's note issue. For if the central bank allows the deposits of the public for the member banks to increase, the public will begin to draw out correspondingly larger amounts of currency, that is, central bank notes. All the dollar bills in your pocket now are central bank notes, the Federal Reserve System. Consequently, the member banks will demand larger supplies of notes from the central bank. The central bank must bear this in mind when it starts to expand credit. And if the total amount of notes it may issue is limited, its powers of expanding credit are also subject to an ultimate limit. In these ways, limits are set to the central bank's powers of increasing the total quantity of money in existence. The limits which are set to its powers of decreasing this quantity of money are those of nature rather than of law. The opposite to making a loan is calling a loan, and the opposite of buying a security is selling it. But a central bank cannot call more loans than it has made, or sell more securities than it has bought. It cannot even sell all its securities or allow all its loans to run off, for the interest it receives on them is the only way it has of earning a living. A definite limit is thus set to the central bank's powers of restricting credit and diminishing the amount of money in existence. Apart altogether from legal and natural restrictions, a central bank in theory is supposed to exercise its great powers with a conscious regard for the best interests of the public. It is indeed often a private institution, but dividends are by custom and not by law limited and invariable, and is not run primarily for profit making. Thus, most central banks keep much higher reserves than they would if they were intent only on making the highest possible profit. We have seen that the cash reserves of member banks can be as low as 10%. But central banks really keep gold to the amount of less than 30% of their liabilities, and the proportion is sometimes as high as 70%. Of course, Switzerland being the best example, and that is why the Swiss money is generally one of the hardest and soundest currencies in the world. Subject then to these limitations, the central bank can determine, absolutely of its own authority, the volume of money that is made available to the public. It fixes the total of the member bank deposits. It is still open to the member banks themselves to determine who shall hold these deposits by varying their different categories of assets. The central bank thus determines the quantity of the supply of money, while the member banks retain their influence over what may be called its quality. Now please turn over the page to page 6. And I want to deal the rest of the lecture with the origin and operations of the Federal Reserve System. Now, the discussion I've just given you about central banking is concerned with general principles of central banking and applies to central banks all over the world. Now we come to the specific instance of a central bank in our own country, the Federal Reserve. And first of all, in order to understand something of its nature and operations, we should deal briefly with something about its origin. The early institutions called the banks of the United States, which existed in the Federal Charter from 1791 to 1811, from 1816 to 1836, were not central banks as we have just defined them. Underlined, they did not have a monopoly of note issue, and they did not stand behind ordinary commercial banks as a source of emergency funds in times of financial panic. Ever since the days of Thomas Jefferson and Andrew Jackson, Americans have been highly suspicious of big banking. And I quote you something there from Vernon Farrington's great work, Main Currents in American Thought. In spite of such suspicions of central banking, the central bank was established in the United States when President Woodrow Wilson signed the act establishing the Federal Reserve System on December 23, 1913. The Reserve Banks opened their doors to business on November 16, 1914. Why? What was the origin of this new system of banking in America? And how does it operate? Has it been a blessing, as its advocates at the time claimed it would be, or a bane, as its opponents, such as Charles A. Lindbergh Sr., father of the famous aviator, told Congress on December 22, 1913, as follows. This act, he said, establishes the most gigantic trust on earth. When the president signs this act, the invisible government by the money power, proven to exist by the money trust investigation, will be legalized. The new law will create inflation whenever the trusts want inflation. From now on, depressions will be scientifically created. The money trust investigation referred to by Lindbergh was the famous Pujo Committee appointed by the Congress to investigate the concentration of control of money and credit. The Pujo Committee, in its final report, pointed out the concentration of the control of the nation's money and credit had been effected chiefly through consolidations of competitive or potentially competitive banks and trust companies, through interlocking directorates and stockholding, through the influence of the powerful banking houses, banks and trust companies brought to bear on insurance companies, railroads, and producing and trading companies. And finally, through partnership arrangements between a few of the leading banking houses in the purchase of security issues, which had the effect of virtually destroying competition. The committee names J.P. Morgan and Company, the First National Bank of New York, and the National City Bank as the most powerful banking unit. In addition to the interests named, the committee believed that Lee Higginson and Company Kidder, Peabody and Company, Kern, Loeb and Company were the principal banking agencies through which the corporate enterprises of the United States obtained capital for their operations. Four allied financial institutions in New York City, it affirmed, held 341 directorships in banks, in transportation, public utility, insurance companies, whose aggregate resources were $22 billion, 245 million. The report concluded, if by money trust is meant an established and well-defined identity and community of interest between a few leaders of finance, which has been created and held together through stock holdings, interlocking directorates, and other forms of domination over banks, trust companies, railroads, public service, and industrial corporations, and which has resulted in a vast and growing concentration of control of money and credit in the hands of a comparatively few men, your committee has no hesitation in asserting, as a result of its investigation, that this condition, largely developed within the past 5 years, exists in this country today. Now, the question we'll try to answer in the rest of this lecture is whether this money trust must be held largely responsible for the creation of the Federal Reserve System, and if so, whether it has ever since used the FDR as to further its own interests rather than those of the people of the United States, as the official policy statement claims of the Federal Reserve System in its book, Purposes and Functions of the FDR. According to the orthodox textbook writers on the subject, the Federal Reserve System was founded to remedy the shortcomings of the national banking system established by the National Banking Act of 1863. The advocates of banking reform, so these writers claim, wanted an elastic currency, or what is called commercial paper. Trade cycles have been an unhappy experience in the United States, as well as in Western Europe. The American monetary system had proved unable to provide a ready conversion of demand deposits into currency. The critics held it largely responsible for the monetary panics of 1873, 84, and 93. The crisis of 1907 and the subsequent recession of business and finance had increased the widespread clamor for banking and currency reform. The 1907 depression led to an acute demand for a centralized reserve-holding institution that would adjust the currency and credit supply of the nation to the needs of business. We need a more flexible currency, the advocates of a reorganization of the American banking system asserted, a currency that can be made to expand or contract in accordance with the needs of business. This flexibility was supposed to eliminate the recurring periods of financial stress and booms and busts, which have plagued the American economy, by providing it with an elastic money supply. The more transactions business carried out, the more businessmen borrowed, the more commercial paper was created, the more banks replenished reserves by borrowing from a central bank, the more notes the banking system as a whole could issue. The reformers appealed to the example of the Reichsbank of Germany. It provided just for such elasticity in its note circulation. Like the Bank of England, it also conducted a discount policy for the protection of general banking liquidity. As such, the Reichsbank had a great appeal for such merchant bankers as Paul Warburg, Aldridge, known as Morgan's floor broker in the Senate, and Cohn and Lowe. So the reformers then wanted to establish a central bank in the United States along the lines of the German Reichsbank. The man who was to play the most significant role in providing America with such a central bank was Paul Warburg. Along with his brother Felix, he had emigrated to the United States from Germany in 1902. They had left their brother Max at home to run the family bank in Frankfurt. Paul married Nina Loeb, daughter of Solomon Loeb of Kuhn, K-U-H-N, Loeb and Company, while Felix married Jacob Schiff's daughter, so his brothers became Kuhn Loeb partners. B.C. Forbes, The Men Who Are Making America, writes to Paul Warburg, Paul Warburg, more than any other man, had made banking reform possible in this country. Trained scientifically in European national and international banking, our anachronistic currency system shocked him. In 1907, Warburg began spending almost all of his time writing and lecturing on the need for bank reform. Working with him in promoting this banking reform was Nelson Aldridge, whose daughter had married John D. Rockefeller Jr. After the panic of 1907, Aldridge was appointed by the Senate to head the National Monetary Commission. In due course, the commission reported back to the Congress, advocating, as might be expected, the establishment of a central bank, though not with that name, for fear of arousing too much opposition. It proposed to set up a new agency, the National Reserve Association, which would issue its own notes, hold deposits for those banks that joined, and make loans to them. It advocated the use of a uniform discount rate, which had been the method used by European central bankers to eliminate competition and create inflation or deflation. Eliminating competition was another proposal of the Aldridge plan for banking reform. Of this part of the scheme, Gabriel Kilko says in The Triumph of Conservatism, the plan would increase the power of the big national banks to compete with the rapidly growing state banks, help bring the state banks under control, and strengthen the position of the national banks in foreign banking activities. End of quote. Because of the strong support by leading bankers in the Republican Party, Aldridge's bill met much opposition from the general public and from the Democratic House of Representatives and was never brought to a vote. Not to be thwarted, the same financial and banking interests then proceeded to exert influence upon the House Committee on Banking and Currency under the chairmanship of Carter Glass. The Glass bill eventually emerged on December 23, 1913, as the Federal Reserve Act. The Federal Reserve Act was, and still is, hailed as a victory of democracy over the money trust. Nothing can be further from the truth. While differing in some important details from Aldridge's plan, the Federal Reserve system as established had the same objectives and many of the same functions. Assessing the differences between the Aldridge and Glass versions, Kilko states, in major areas, the differences between the two plans were of degree rather than of kind, and if anything, the new act provided for substantially greater centralization. Now, who exactly controls the Federal Reserve System? Much controversy has taken place over just who does own the Federal Reserve System. We are told the stock is owned by all the 12 Federal Reserve banks. Please turn to the chart now and give you some idea of what we're talking about. You have the Board of Governors, 7 members appointed by the President, confirmed by the Senate, the Federal Advisory Council, Federal Reserve Banks, each bank having 9 directors, and the member banks, about 6,150. And then you have the various committees, and you have the various ways by which they control the whole system, which we shall see in a moment. Notes on page 14. The Federal Reserve Banks are found in the following cities of Boston, New York, Philadelphia, Cleveland, Richmond, Atlanta, Chicago, St. Louis, Minneapolis, Kansas, Dallas, San Francisco. In addition, 12 banks, to these 12 banks, the system includes 24 branch banks. Well, please turn back to the text. Now, we are told then that the stock is owned by all the 12 Federal Reserve banks, which receive a dividend of 6% per year. The balance of the FDR's profits is said to be turned back to the Treasury. Because the Federal Reserve Act was modeled after the European central banks, which were privately owned, profit-making institutions, many have speculated that our system has secret Class A stockholders. No one knows the answer, and just remember this, please. No one knows the answer for the simple reason the Federal Reserve banks have successfully resisted every attempt at an audit. Now, that's very strange. Every other business of the country has to undergo an audit But apparently, the great men who sit in the Federal Reserve System feel they are above auditing and above the law. As a result, we cannot tell whether they are individual earners or if vast private profits are being drained from the system. In his pamphlet, The Bankers and the Federal Reserve, Gary Allen suggests in this regard, it seems unlikely the insiders will risk exposure that they own the Federal Reserve when the really important feature is their control over the system, by which they manipulate interest rates and the money supply. Control is the important factor. Then he goes on to say, the original Federal Reserve Board was largely handpicked by Colonel House and included Paul Warburg. The appointment of Paul Warburg to the Federal Reserve Board should have exposed as a hoax the idea still pushed in American classrooms that the creation of the Federal Reserve was a great triumph of democracy, having stripped the Wall Street barons of their power. The fact is, the entire monetary reform movement was instigated by and financed by the very international monopolists it was supposed to be bringing to heel. And then in case you dispute Mr. Allen as being an extremist, I suggest you read yourself what I put down there, the quotation from Gabriel Coco, The Triumph of Conservatism. The Federal Reserve banks can best be regarded as if they're all one bank. Now, please underline that. Even though there are 12 regional banks. Most policy decisions are unified. Only administrative details are left to the discretion of the individual banks. Member banks are creditors, in that they deposit their cash in the reserve banks, much as individuals deposit currency in commercial banks. Originally, the member banks deposited treasury currency and gold with the reserve banks, and they were given reserve bank credit as their reserve asset. The FDR was originally required to maintain a gold reserve of 40% against its currency notes in circulation. The reserve banks also had to keep on hand in lawful money 35% of all their deposits. The power structure of the Federal Reserve System is complex because the administrative role of the reserve banks has never been rigorously separated from the policy-making function. The individual reserve banks handle most of the administrative details of member banks in their respective districts, such as clearinghouse operations. Any check you write out in your bank passes through one of these branch banks of the Federal Reserve System. In the early days of the system, the only policy at the discretion of the board was the discount rate at the reserve banks. And even this power was originally held by the reserve banks themselves. In actual fact, the discount rate policy has almost always been exercised by the board on a system-wide basis. Now, in theory, the president appoints the members of the Board of Governors. The president has to be elected, and no president since 1910 has ever got himself elected over the opposition of international bankers who control the money trust and pull the financial wires which control the mass media. The power of the Eastern banking lobby to make or break any politician is simply enormous. The original Federal Reserve Board was largely handpicked by Colonel House and included the chief advocate of banking reform, Mr. Paul Warburg, of the merchant banking house of Kern, Loeb & Company of New York, which helped to finance the Bolshevik Revolution. If you don't believe me, read Colonel Beattie's great work, The Iron Curtain Over America. Given such a method of appointing the governors of the Federal Reserve System, it is not surprising most of the men who have served in this capacity have sought to further not the interest of the nation, but the interest of the money trust, to whom they owe their appointment. As Ferdinand Lundberg writes in America's 60 Families, in practice, the Federal Reserve Bank of New York became the fountainhead of the system of 12 regional banks, for New York was the money market for the nation. The other 11 banks were so many mausoleums erected to solve the local pride and quell the Jacksonian fears of the hinterland. Benjamin Strong president of the Morgan Bankers Trust Company, was selected as the first governor of the New York Reserve Bank. An adept in high finance, Strong for many years manipulated the country's monetary systems at the discretion of directors representing the leading New York banks. Under Strong, the reserve system, unsuspected by the nation, was brought into interlocking relations with the Bank of England and the Bank of France. Now, I go on to discuss how the system operates. It has three main ways of manipulating the American monetary and financial system. In the beginning, as we pointed out, the reformers had only asked for one such method of control, namely the rediscounting instrument. Rediscounting. Promissory notes, drafts, and bills of exchange, growing out of actual commercial transactions, and with a maturity not to exceed 90 days, accepted by the commercial banks, and then rediscounted with the Federal Reserve, this constituted by law the base and boundary for the money the Federal Reserve could create. Thus, a direct causal connection was to be established between the money supply and its demand. Since the total of commodity bills, rediscounted, was supposed to be determined by the intensity of the economic life, basing the money supply on that total was supposed to bring about a perfect adjustment of the supply to the fluctuating needs of business. This arrangement was supposed to have made money neutral, smoothly rendering the vital service of a medium of exchange without affecting prices. Of course, it did no such thing. For the volume of paper thus offered, the Federal Reserve for rediscount, and hence the amount of currency and credit it could feed into the economy, was determined primarily by the rediscount rate, of which the Fed itself established it could change at will. As so often happens, the reformers had got the cart before the horse. And also by 1935, the boundaries in this channel of operations had been materially widened. The paper presented to the Fed for advances to its member banks no longer had to arise out of commercial transactions. It could even be government securities. If the notes, drafts, or bills of exchange had been drawn for agricultural purposes, they could now have a maturity of 9 months instead of three. In addition to banks, now individuals, partnership and corporations have been given access to the discounting facilities of the system. Finally, in 1942, the federal government was authorized to borrow up to $5 billion directly from the Federal Reserve. And every loan the Federal Reserve System made to any borrower for any purpose, under these relaxing conditions, gave it the authority to issue that much more currency or credit in the form of a bookkeeping entry subject to the check of the borrower. The second tool of the Federal Reserve System is its authorization to buy or sell certain securities in the open market. The original Act granted it this power to buy and sell obligations of the United States and any state, county, district, political subdivision, or municipality in the United States. By the 1920s, it was recognized these open market transactions by the reserve banks offered an important method of central credit control. So a concentration of power into the hands of one regulatory body was advocated. Legislation enacted in 1933 decreed that no Federal Reserve Bank should engage in open market operations except in accordance with the regulations adopted by the Board of Governors. To improve and formalize the centralization, the Open Market Committee was organized, and in 1935, an amendment to the 33 Act finally provided, quote, no Federal Reserve Bank should engage or decline to engage in open market operations except in accordance with the direction of and regulations adopted by the committee. With this tool in familiar use, the Federal Reserve System no longer had to wait for member banks to ask for discounts and advances at whatever rate it set in order to affect the money supply. Underline the next sentence. It could do so directly on its own initiative by buying or selling securities to make the money and capital markets more liquid or more tight as it might wish. For in payment for securities, the Fed merely draws on itself a check which constitutes newly created money. Then, as this check is deposited by the recipient at his bank and redeposited by that bank, it winds up as an addition to the reserve account of some bank of the Federal Reserve. And hence it becomes the basis for the creation by a member bank of new credit, to the extent of many times the amount of the actual new money. Open market operations of the Fed may deal in long-term securities. Thus, they may affect directly long-term interest rates and yields, and this effect is immediate. They are therefore quite comprehensive, as well as a very powerful instrument of control or disturbance of the American monetary system. For this reason, such operations have high prestige and preference in the plans of the money managers, and they are favorably described by most textbook writers in Money and Banking. And finally, the third weapon, the third and most powerful instrument of credit control in the hands of the Federal Reserve System, is its authority to change the reserve requirements of its member banks. Both the rediscount process and the open market transactions either increase or decrease member bank reserves, and hence the amount of credit which these banks can make available. But changing the percentage of its deposits which a bank must keep as reserve is an even more drastic form of control and manipulation of the nation's money and credit supply. For suppose a bank has $1 million of demand deposits. If the reserve requirement is 10%, it must keep $100,000 in its reserve account with a Federal Reserve Bank. It may loan out or invest the rest. But if the reserve requirement should now be lowered, let us say to 5%, our bank would need only $50,000 as a reserve against its demand deposits. It could now lend or invest the remaining $50,000. If this were the whole effect, only $50,000 of additional money would have entered the economy. In reality, however, this is merely the beginning of a chain of multiple money creation. Now, there's some mistakes here, please, and these figures. Just follow closely. Let us assume that one bank buys $50,000 of additional securities. The seller of the securities deposits the $50,000 he receives in another bank. This increases the deposits and the reserves on hand of that bank by $50,000. Now, this is where the mistake is. That bank now holds back a reserve of $5,000, it should be, or $2,500 against its increased deposits, and itself spends the remaining $47,500 or $45,000 in the purchase of additional securities. This process continues until total bank deposits have been expanded by $1 million. For the lowering of reserve requirements from 10% to 5% frees $50,000 in reserves out of the $1 million on deposit with the first bank in the chain. And that $50,000 with a 5% reserve ratio in effect will support 20 times itself, or $1 million in additional bank loans and demand deposits. This is an oversimplification of the bank expansion and credit destruction process, but it is sufficient to show how the huge impact, on the capital and money market of changes in reserve requirements. Now notice this, it is estimated that at present, a fluctuation of only 1% tends to increase or decrease the total volume of bank credit by more than $6 billion. This authority to vary reserve requirements was given to the Federal Reserve System as a special emergency power to deal with the appalling conditions of the Great Depression, which previous Federal Reserve policies are thought by many economists to have brought about. And if you don't believe me, read Murray Rothbard's great book, The Great Depression. Now, there should be a capital A, beginning of the next sentence. As with most such emergency powers, such as was most accidentally powers asked for by reformers, it has become a permanent instrument of credit control. Now, we conclude this lecture by asking the question, has this new system of banking been a blessing? Now remember, it was only established in 1914. We got through 200 years of our history quite well without it. And the question is, has it been a blessing to the people? Now we know it's been a blessing to the money trust, obviously. Otherwise they wouldn't have gone on supporting it. Any appraisal of the Federal Reserve System depends on the political and economic philosophy of the appraiser, and ultimately upon his religion. If you favor centralized planning control of our American economy, as most liberal textbook writers seem to do today, you will regard the Federal Reserve most favorably, for it has given to the reformers absolute power over the people's money and savings and credit. And despite its technical ownership by the member banks, it operates as an agency of the money trust, an agency which regulates the money and credit of the nation supplied along lines dictated by the interests of the reformers and planners. The entire monetary reform movement was instigated and financed by the very international financial oligarchy it was supposed to be bringing to heel. As Professor Gabriel Coker writes, the banking reform movement was initiated and sustained by big bankers seeking to offset, through political means, the diffusion and centralization within banking. If you are convinced, on the other hand, of the benefits of the free enterprise competitive market system, you will probably reject the Federal Reserve System. You will condemn it as the controlling body of a centralized statist industry. You will blame it for having shattered the American dollar, for having caused the booms, busts, recessions, and depressions which have plagued America since 1921, and for having given the 50-odd years of its existence the period's fundamental characteristic and unprecedented economic instability. It is this financial instability of the past 50 years which fostered the growth of statism and collectivism that have proved to be so hostile to individual freedom and the rule of law. The Federal Reserve, through its policies of boom and bust, helped to create the conditions which ushered in the New Deal, the Fair Deal, and all the other deals offered by the reformers. Today, it acts as midwife to the ever more centralized control of the nation's credit and money. Four, with practically all legislative restrictions removed, the seven members of the Board of Governors have in their hands the greatest economic power ever held by so few men in the history of these United States. And please remember for the rest of your life the next sentence. It is the power to change the content of every deferred payment, to increase or decrease the real value of every bond, mortgage, insurance policy, and other forms of saving. It is a supreme power over all prices, wages, profits, employment, and unemployment. Until March the 3rd, there existed one powerful constraint on the power of the Federal Reserve to increase member bank reserves. This limit existed because the reserve banks were themselves subject to a reserve requirement imposed by the Congress, which stipulated that the federal banks hold gold certificates equal to at least 25% of their total liabilities. That is, member bank reserves, deposits, other deposits, and Federal Reserve notes outstanding. The purposes of these reserve requirements at the Federal Reserve Bank level were to create confidence in reserve bank liabilities and to place limits on the volume of credit creation. And then I go on to show you how they whittled away these restrictions so that today there's not even the requirement of having a gold reserve at all. Go to the bottom of the page. So the inflationary effects of the Fed's limitations to expand reserves without a corresponding gold backing, Murray Rothbard writes, in what has government done to our money? In a free banking system, inflation by any one bank would soon lead to demand for redemption by the other banks, since the clientele of any one bank is limited. But the central bank, by pumping reserves into all the banks, can make sure they all expand together and at a uniform rate. If all banks are expanding, then there is no redemption problem of one bank upon another, and each bank finds its clientele is rid of the whole country. Underline the next point. In short, the limits on bank expansion are immeasurably widened from the clientele of each bank to that of the whole banking system. Of course, this means that no bank can expand further than the central bank design. And he goes on to show that the central bank can stimulate inflation, the last paragraph of his quote, by pouring reserves into the banking system and also by lowering the required reserve ratio and thus permitting a nationwide bank credit expansion. Does such inflation really matter? Liberal radical economists think it does not. The President Eisenhower, in many remarks about inflation, indicated it would result in the growing regimentation of our lives by the federal government and that the road from inflation to socialism would be inevitable. In my last lecture of the course, I suggest it's not socialism we're going to finish up with, but fascism. But that's from the last lecture. I disagree with Professor Singer on that. He calls it socialism. I call it fascism. First, the planners and reformers in Washington clamor for an expansion of the volume of money and credit in order to bring about or sustain a boom, prosperity, and full employment. They rejoice over wage boosts, but dislike the parallel price rises and the hardships caused to those with fixed income. They like one set of inflationary effects, but decry the inevitable twin set. And the reformers are always anxious to do something about these undesired effects should be of their own financial policies. In order to fight inflation, they want to curb our economic actions with a series of fascist-like controls. They want credit controls, price controls, wage controls, all other kinds of government controls over our lives. I think I read somewhere this year that the average American businessman now is faced with filling out at least 600 different forms of one sort or another for government at either the federal, state, or local level. Thus, an acceleration of the present long-range credit expansion cannot but lead America into exactly the fully controlled economy the reformers and planners want. Under these conditions, the Federal Reserve System is the most important tool in the armory of violent economic interventionism. In the words of the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve System, it is the system's objective, quote, to help counteract inflationary and deflationary movements, to share in the increasing conditions favorable to sustain high employment, stable values, growth of the country, and a rising level of consumption. This is interventionism at its boldest, with all the planners' usual assumption of their own benevolent omniscience. An institution which was established under the guise of a cooperative undertaking by the banks of the United States to pool their resources has developed into the right hand of the centralizers in promoting their New Deal, their Fair Deal, and the Great Society objectives. The fallacies of central planning of the economy are being substituted for the hard but lasting truths of the private enterprise system. And the Federal Reserve System supplies the magician's cloth under which the substitution is made. It's part in the revolutionary transformation of the American free enterprise system into a state-controlled system has not been limited to the maintenance of so-called cheap money in order to prolong or create a boom. The reformers, and this is, I think, very important, the reformers, underline this, also provide the government itself with the money, at least the Fed should be also provide the government itself with the money the reformers think they should have, beyond the amount they dare take directly in taxes. The Fed facilitates the government's own inflationary financing in periods of emergency, largely brought about by the failure of the reformers' own schemes. It makes easy the inflationary financing of budget deficits and the inflationary funding of government loans by buying government bonds. It stabilizes the government bond market through inflationary methods and manipulates this market to the advantage of the government and the money trust. It does all of this by wrecking the purchasing power of the dollar, by subtly stealing from the people of these United States what it thus provides for the government, through a process exactly similar to the coin flipping of heathen kings of old, but much more diabolical because so much less visible. It is no answer to these facts the present Board of Governors, led by Mr. Burns, are honorable men with the best of intentions. The road to hell has been paved with good intentions. That indeed is what makes its reformers so dangerous to human liberty. The simple truth is, without the Federal Reserve System, there can be no continuing... There can be no continuing march towards a totalitarian state, and with it, there can be no free economy. That is why the adherence of liberty under the laws of the God of the Bible cannot rest until the Federal Reserve System has been abolished. Over 120 years ago, Karl Marx enumerated in the Communist Manifesto 10 prerequisites for successful overthrowing of the ancient societies of Christendom and the conversion of the world into the society of the Antichrist. He said, point 5, centralization of credit in the hands of the state by means of a national bank with state capital and an exclusive monopoly. And then turn to the reference on page 15, reference number 18, the even more remarkable piece of prophecy. I've always said that Marx was an apostate prophet of ancient Israel. He's prophesied everything that's come to pass. Point 2, you see, call for a heavy progressive or graduated income tax. And notice, the 16th Amendment was ratified in February 1913, authorizing the collection of a federal income tax, thus providing the money interest with a means to charge interest on the debts they plan to make on the American people through the national debt. As a result, Wilson was able to spend nearly twice as much in 8 years as all the other American presidents before him had spent in 125 years. And I go on to argue in the main lecture that since the abolition of the gold standard, these objectives of the communists have been realized in America and Canada for all essential purposes. The Federal Reserve System constitutes its realization. Of these ominous developments, Rush Dooney writes in The Nature of the American System. When the U.S. federal government wants money, $100 million, for example, it prints and turns over interest-bearing bonds for that amount to the Federal Reserve System, which then creates money by simply asking the U.S. Bureau of Engraving to print up $100 million. Three things are immediately created, as it were, out of nothing. One, $100 million in paper money, a debt for those interest-bearing bonds, which will take more than that $100 million to satisfy. But three, money, the measure and medium of wealth, now represents not wealth, but debt. And the existence of most paper currency represents an almost irredeemable debt and mortgage against the entire country. Money that is itself debt cannot retire debt, because it represents every day of its existence an increasing interest debt against the country above and beyond its face value. Although it is said of the national debt, we owe it to ourselves, in actuality, we owe it to the money lenders who are in and behind the Federal Reserve System. Thus, although politicians may promise a balanced budget, they're likely to gain power by increasing debt, for in a debt-free country, the citizenry is strong and the civil government is limited. In a debt-ridden country, taxes increase, liberties decrease, the civil government increases its own power over the people, even as it vastly enlarges the power of the invisible government overall. By invisible government, I think he means the money trust. All in all, it is clear that debt is the road to slavery, and the Christian, both as a person and in his organized society, must recognize the truth of Scripture when it orders, owe no man anything but to love one another. Romans 13:8. A truly Christian order means not only a severely limited order with respect to time limits on debt, but also severely restricted with respect to usury. It cannot be one of debt money and of a debt economy. I thank you.